PhD.
Oh, that's a philosopher's stone. There's another one of those eggs. And you know, it's really interesting on the philosopher's stone. In alchemy, right, which is actually what I'm doing. You know, alchemy just means the fusing and casting of metals. That's what it originally started out to be. You know, it didn't, you know, transmutation of lead into gold.
What bronze is, right?
Yeah.
It's an alchemical creation.
Yeah, right, sure. It's, you know, it's copper and tin.
Right.
And brass is copper and zinc. And if you look at zinc, you can see why this is much more fluid than the zinc would. Yeah, I mean, with the tin in it. But, and so what happens is there's, that's on its site. So what happens is, takes 12 steps to make the philosopher's stone, you see. And a lot of these alchemists, you know, really did pull it off at 1200, 1500, you know, Paracelsus and some of those guys really did. And this was the first beginning of, Paracelsus was 15th century alchemist. And, what he did, he was the first one. See, at that time, what they used to do is they would treat the sword that had stabbed you or whatever, and then they shove horseshit in the wound, you know, and they'd have the sword all wrapped up really nice and on a mantle someplace, and they're pushing horseshit into the wound, you know. So he was one of the first ones that said, hey, you know, let's keep that wound clean. That's the best thing you can do. And that was a big thing. He was the first one to ever talk about mental health as a disease and how it should be treated and that kind of thing. So a lot of these alchemists really did. And one of the things about the philosopher's stone is that it the steps go on. And when you're reading about alchemy, it's done in a code so that people can't abuse it, right? So I was reading, I've read about 5-6 books on alchemy. I wasn't really. But in the thing they'll say, and when you see the tail of a peacock, right, will be part of it. You know, they'll have the emperor and the empress, you know, and then they'll say, when you see the tail of a peacock. So I'm reading about these things and doing this thing, and all of a sudden I'm working with the bronze, and I hit it with my torch, and this iridescent color comes across. I said, that's it. That's what they were talking about, the tail of a peacock, right?
Right.
It's for a temperature, for whatever, because that's what it all was about. So what these guys used to do is they used to go, they were astronomers and all of that kind of thing. They found out that when Halley's Comet or one of those things passed by, there's actually radiation that's leached off of it as it passes over. So what they would do is they would position themselves to be under the passing of something like this. They would arrange it almost like in Frankenstein, you know, when they open up the top and they got all these electrical things and there's lead holding these metal deals. I mean, it was almost like that. And they'd have it all set up. And meanwhile, they'd have a fertilized date. Because that had all properties, right? And so they have a fertilized egg, and they incubate it. They'd incubate this egg, and one of the things that they used was mercury, because they felt at this time that if mercury in its fixed state was cinnabar, you know, it's kind of a red ore, and in its liquid state, I don't know if you have to heat it up or what you do with it, but probably nobody lives to tell how you do it. You know?
If you heat it up, it separates out somehow. You know.
Oh, yeah, like okay, so that's whatever, what happens. So that would be another thing that they would put in it. They would call that maybe the prince. And then they would take two other things, kind of a yin-yang, and that would be the emperor and the empress. And they would put all of these things together, and they would incubate this thing. And there's like so many steps. There's usually 12 steps to go through the whole thing. And then they would open it up, open up this thing when they're ready. I mean, they would be sometimes 10, 15 years projecting it to be right at the right spot, the whole thing. And they take it up to maybe the 12th. And the Philosopher's Stone, at that point, you could do anything with it. It'd cure anything, you know. But what they really saw was they saw the transmutation, and they understood it at this point. They had no need to see the gold or to do any of that. A lot of these guys shut it off, you know. Mm-hmm. After they saw everything transmute, that was enlightenment to them. They didn't need anything else.
Hmm.
And a lot of times they just turn off the furnace or whatever it was and walk away from it, and you'd never hear from them again.
More or less like just proving the concept.
Yeah, the concept that this was possible. And they had to purify themselves. You see, this had to be, you know, it's the same kind of a concept with a Japanese, you know, say sword maker and that kind of thing. While the sword has to be made from pure essence, you have to be at that same essence, or they don't come together. Mm. And that's what happens with the Philosopher's Stone. This is a cure-all. It's also transmutation. There's a snake down here, you know, you know, that's laying on the rock. I mean, on that up there. And
I was like the puddles.
Yeah, and that's what the puddles are, you know. It's like... I remember one time, it was, in fact, it was right down the road here. Pam had a client down the road that she had to stop off and see. And I was depressed about something. And I was sitting in the truck or where we were driving at that point. And I was really kind of, I was going, you know, nothing was going right for me, you know. And I looked down at this puddle. And I saw everything kind of in reverse in the puddle. And I said, I like that. I feel okay with that. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, it just gives you some kind of a boundaries. You know, when you look up, you don't have any boundaries. You know, it's just wide open. But within that subconscious, that's what I call a subconscious barrier, it's defined. And that gives you something to work with. So most all my pieces have that on the bottom.
Hmm. I was trying to remember what Douglas Adams said about puddles.
What?
He was talking about evolution and how everyone says, well, you know, the Earth is too perfect for us to have just been evolved here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's got to be God or somebody else because there's no way.
Yeah.
Everything seems perfect for us. And it's like he was like, well, ask the puddle why the hole that he lives in is the perfect shape for him. You know? Because the puddle is defined by the shape that it's in.
Right.
Not
right.
The other way around.
Sure,
so
sure.
The fact that we're fitting the earth means that we grew up here. This is mm-hmm. where we, you know. So I always like that. It kind of, he didn't, you know, he said a lot better than me, but I like the idea of the puddles. They're thinking, oh, this puddle-sized hole,
sure,
just by a miracle, is the right size for me.
Sure, sure.
No,
and it's a lake too. You know, it's a lake.
Same.
It's, you know, it's the same thing.
There's a reason why your puddles are never larger than the holes they're in.
Yeah.
But it probably isn't God.
You know, I'm going to find that quote by Huxley too. About where he talks about bronze and, you know, as you work up the scales. I thought it was in Doors of Perception, but I don't think it was. I think it was in the book that he wrote about mescaline. And I think it was in that, but I'm going to get that book. I don't have that one. I had Doors of Perception, but I was looking for that so I could say, well, yeah, it's on page 22 or something like that. Where he talked about when you look at a sparkle in a diamond, you know, it triggers something in your subconscious. You know, something that you long ago buried, but you look at it with some kind of a kinship. And he said, you know, like the light at the end of the tunnel, you know, with the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it's the first bardo with the white light. And then when... he says that in metals, he says the first place that this happens as the lower metals work up, is in bronze. And bronze has tin, which is the Aquarian Age metal, and supposed to correspond with that. I don't know how they work that out. But that sparkles there, and that's what does it. And that's one of the things that I use in my work, is that sparkle. And what I'll do a lot of times with a piece is I'll set it up in front of the drums. And I'll just sit there and play drums. And if I get hung up on a spot, you know, it's like with the Chinese landscape. It's supposed to start off here, be able to work, be able to go across and look at some boats, and then all of a sudden you'd see the mountains move up, and then you look at the clouds, and then you'll drop back down, and they control every way that you're going to look. I mean, if, you know, right from the beginning. You always start on the lower right-hand side. They'll take you right out there and drop you back again. And I do that with bronze. I'll play drums. And then if I get hung up on a spot, see, that's the difference between Sumi ink and that kind of stuff. Sumi ink, it's there.
Mm.
You can't change it. But with bronze, I can go back there and I can just torch it.
More like carving, see? You can never add wood back.
Yeah, you can't add, yeah.
But with metals, you know, that's one thing I liked just about general welding was you can create and destroy. And
you got the whole ball of wax, yeah.
Pretty cool.